From the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end of what's really happening in your old North State.
Hello, North Carolina. I'm here with my good friend, Brooke Medina. We're going to be talking Hurricane Florence and civil society and a lot on our latest Civitas poll results. Brooke, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well and really kind of just thinking a lot about this hurricane and, you know, what are we going to do? What have you kind of been doing to prepare? What kind of things have you seen around Raleigh?
Okay, so we have, as a family, been preparing by just accumulating some propane, the kind that you take camping, just in case power outages occur. We plan on staying in the area. So, you know, with the new trajectory of the storm, we're pretty comfortable with continuing that plan of staying in this area. And I know those that are on the radio listening to this, they won't actually hear this until Florence has actually made landfall. So Right. We'll see if I regret staying in the area at that point in time. But we've been getting like propane tanks and a bunch of batteries and lots of SpaghettiOs. My kids like SpaghettiOs.
Yeah.
We've got Spider-Man SpaghettiOs, got princess ones. But
non-perishable food is probably the best. I must be a little bit of a Luddite because I have a lot of charcoal.
Oh, okay.
No propane, but I'm a big fan of charcoal, so I've got a lot of charcoal stored away, and you know, obviously,
that's a smart idea too.
Yeah, just
and
don't
good
use it.
Flavor.
Don't use it indoors. I saw people tweeting, "Don't use charcoal indoors," and I was like, "Man, it's sad in a way that has to be, you know, out there." But there's always that one person, so don't use your charcoal indoors or grill indoors with that.
That is the Civitalk PSA for the day, the week. Let's not hear of any charcoal accidents like that, but. Anyways, yeah, so we've been preparing by doing that, but also just talking to our kids about the hurricane. The older ones are obviously more aware of what's going on. They're paying attention to the news, and there's been a little bit of concern and anticipation. Not really sure. They don't remember going through the last hurricane. I think we were actually living on the West Coast the last time a big hurricane hit this area. Well, Matthew, of course, hit Fayetteville, though, which is where I'm from, and that, you know, devastated that whole area.
Do you have phone chargers, like portable phone chargers?
So we have a couple. What about you?
Yeah, we definitely have like four, I think. Okay. Four or five.
Oh, wow. You have a lot.
Yeah, I think Kelly gets them free at Campbell. So, and I've had a free from work, and so I had to dig them out. I never use them, but, you know, we just had to dig it out, and so we have a few.
Yeah, so we have a Mophie charger, and that one lasts.
I have no idea what that
is.
It's
a special. It's a good brand one, and it cost us a little bit more money, but I think in the long run, it's definitely worth it. And then my husband yesterday was able to actually grab a generator. There were some still available.
That's nice.
They had actually just restocked at the Lowe's off of Capitol Boulevard in Raleigh, and so he got a tip. So ran on over there to get one. So we feel prepared, but you know, it's just.
We live in a society that
we're not sure
that doesn't deal well with power outages anymore. And so
oh, no.
I think that, you know, and I just remember that from last Matthew. I think we lost power for may have been 2 days almost in Johnson County, where I live in Johnson County. And there was a lot of freak out. I was getting kind of restless, like, you know, because you're used to picking up your phone. I think our phones had died at some point. You could charge it in your car. You can do a few things, but you're used to just having everything at your fingertips. And I think that's a challenge, you know, obviously now more so than it was in the past. And especially if you have like teenagers in your house or people who are just constantly in front of screens all day long. Fortunately, I have a lot of books and I like to read, but I also now have a wild card in the factor. I have a 19-month-old son and he has.
He's not reading books like you are?
No, right now he has. We've been pretty good about like limiting TV because I know TV is not good for kids under two, especially. But you know, occasionally you just give in just a little bit. And he has a Melmo addiction. He calls him Melmo. It's Elmo, but he has this Melmo addiction. So it'll be hard to explain that when he demands Melmo, that you know, if we lose power for an extended time, that you just can't sit and watch Melmo.
That's the unfortunate thing, navigating a hurricane and possible power outages with the iGen, the iGeneration, because oh my goodness, the digital area is their playground.
Yeah,
nowadays.
It's amazing these little kids can just pick up a phone.
Yeah, it's totally hardwired
like,
into
you know,
them.
They're mimicking us, but to me, it's sad. There's going to be an evolutionary change at some point where kids in the womb are going to have like crooked necks or stuff because they're trying to
get close to the phone. They're going to have
texting
thumbs and new conditions.
I think, you know, for real, I mean, if we continue on for, you know, thousands of more years, there will be documented evolutionary changes because of iPhones and cell phones.
I think it's already happening. So, and that's pretty sobering to think that it has actually occurred already, and we've only had this kind of technology for a couple decades now. But yeah, so anyways, we as parents are mentally preparing for potential power outages, thinking about how we're going to navigate that. And hey, look, kids, there's actually books you can read, and you're actually going to have to read them unless you want to play with your toys and not digital stuff.
A long time ago, Thomas Jefferson was famous for this, but he would go to bed, and a lot of people did this, wasn't unusual, but when the sun went down, he would go to bed. And as soon as there was any sort of sunlight, people would get up because that was the most productive part of the day. Now, you know, some of us binge watch TV at night or do different things that require power, obviously. And so to me, you just kind of have to have that mindset a little bit of like, you know, I'm going to go to bed early. I'm going to get up with the sunlight because that's, you know, the light that you have and the light that's available to you.
Yeah. Well, I am looking forward to actually catching up on some reading should the power go out, but I would prefer it not go out longer than 6 hours. So that's my little request. Hopefully the energy companies are listening in so that they can stay attuned to my preferences. But let's talk a little bit about the more serious aspect of hurricane, as well as civil society's role in addressing hurricane recovery and kind of getting in front of that. Can you share a little bit about something you wrote recently on this?
Yeah, I mean, some of you may know this, but I was a Katrina evacuee. I lived on the Mississippi Gulf Coast for a long time. Fortunately, when Katrina hit, I had somewhere to go. I was in seminary at the time up in Kentucky. I took the back roads out because, the interstate was just completely jammed, and I was able to get out on back roads with no map. You know, it's before I owned a cell phone, and I just went by the compass in my Jeep, and that was, I could navigate how to get out of there. I was on dirt roads for a while. But anyways, just watching what happened in Louisiana, Mississippi had a catastrophic hit. But, you know, people forget that New Orleans really didn't get hit by the hurricane. What happened was the levees broke, and that created a nightmare scenario. And just watching sort of the response by the government there, Kathleen Blanco was the governor at the time. She ended up losing because of her hurricane response. You had Mayor Ray Nagin in New Orleans who got raked over the coals for his hurricane response. There's all that just, you know, that depiction of the buses just all in a huge lot, hadn't been utilized. A lot of resources in the city were not utilized for evacuation. Of course, you had the nightmare scenario in the Superdome and just a lot of stuff. And so, with the Katrina and George W. Bush got raked over the coals for just sort of flying over and looking out the window. And I think when we think about civil society and the response, you know, our inclination as citizens is to look to the federal government first and forget civil society, forget the charitable organizations that are so effective when it comes to hurricane response. I know in Katrina, and I'm just referencing Katrina because that's the hurricane that I had the most familiarity with, it was Southern Baptist Disaster Relief, other parachurch organizations that were the first to cut through the rubble. And you had a massive hurricane that hit the Gulf Coast. And they had cut through the rubble. They had hot meals up the next day.
Wow.
And it was just amazing to see the church response. And there's Mennonites now that now live in the coastal areas of Louisiana and Mississippi that have come down there permanently to help rebuild. I mean, they resettled in that area, Mennonites from parts of Pennsylvania. So to me, it's just, you know, a lot of times we look to the federal government to solve sort of a catastrophe or a national disaster like this, and they often don't have the resources. And part of that's because they're you know, they have a huge bureaucracy. They don't, you know, they have to means test who they can help, and there's all kinds of forms you have to fill out. But the church and other charitable organizations that are equipped to help can cut through some of that bureaucracy. And I think that's something that we need to think about more. And, you know, Donald had a good post the other day about the importance of giving. And I think, too, when we think of giving, you know, sometimes we don't know how to give, but it's important to give to the organizations that have the resources to help. And they don't have a lot of overhead. And one of the things that some people have criticized the Red Cross for is because they have a lot of overhead. I know that when they had the tornadoes in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, sometimes the Red Cross was criticized because they were in big hotels, you know, with their staff and stuff. And they had a lot of overhead. And I know they do a lot of great things, but some of these church organizations, every penny goes to the rescue and relief effort.
Absolutely. And that is actually why we wrote about this on ncivitas.org. Donald, our CEO, listed several organizations. He listed them, but by no means is this list exhaustive. There are plenty of others. But like you mentioned, some of these ones that we've placed on our website as possible places that you could begin making donations to in front of this hurricane, they just don't have a lot of overhead, and they are the boots on the ground when it comes to this. And it just goes to show how effective civil society can be.
Absolutely.
And the importance of that. That doesn't mean that government doesn't can help with recovery efforts and things like that. We know that that is important. However, there are some of these ministries like Samaritan's Purse, Second Harvest Food Bank, Salvation Army, North Carolina Baptist Men, and another food bank in Central and Eastern North Carolina. These are the ones we've listed. There are plenty of others. If you're watching on Facebook, go ahead and post those other ministries that you would recommend online. Go ahead and post them so our audience can have access to their information as well. But these people truly are, they're volunteering their time. They're people from maybe the parts of the state that aren't impacted by the hurricane, or they're even coming from other states. You mentioned the Mennonites in Pennsylvania. And we can't say enough about how important and crucial it is to invest in organizations like this so that they can actually be the boots on the ground, meeting some needs that the government, just because of its breadth and its slow moving nature that's inherently built into it, is unable to do. So
that's a good point, Brooke. Another point I made in a post that I wrote was, along with civil society, you know, sometimes we're anti-business or anti-corporation. One of the things that we detest during a hurricane, of course, is price gouging. But a lot of these big box stores have the resources to reach people. I know that I saw a WRAL article about Food Lion. And I know a lot of the big box stores, Walmart, Target, they're pushing more resources to this area, whether it be gas, you know, water, food, other supplies. And I know part of that is, you know, increasing profit margins, but it's also meeting a need. It's also reaching out and directing more resources to North Carolinians that need it. And so, you know, I think that's a good thing, obviously. And I'm just, you know, you're just always, I think, lightened in the heart, and you get a joyful response when you sort of see just the amount of resources that go into helping people. And the government just doesn't have all of those resources. There's things they can do. They've got, you know, wildland firefighters. They've got so many great different groups that can come and help with the recovery effort. But people sometimes forget that the government is the slowest to respond. And in some cases, when it comes to meeting immediate needs, they're the least effective.
Yeah, that's the case. And that's just reality, folks. It's not Civitas or the Civitalk hosts being anti-government. It's nope. My husband works in the federal government. I mean, it's just the nature of that beast. And so, again, go check out nccivitas.org. We've got Ray's piece when he's talking about his observations from hurricanes past, as well as ways that you can help those directly impacted by Florence.
Yeah.
So we are thinking about and praying for those on the coastline in particular. And we will continue to post any other helpful resources on our website and on our Facebook. But Ray, let's go ahead and switch gears, because we had some significant polling released earlier this morning on North Carolina's second congressional district, which is incumbent George Holding. And that polling indicates something that we were sort of foreseeing for the past few weeks, but Holding's district is historically a Republican stronghold. Am I correct in saying that?
Absolutely. George Holding hasn't had any problems, to my knowledge, of winning re-election. I know he was redistricted and pushed into that district. It used to be Renee Elmer's district. And so, you know, in the very recent history, I know that Bob Etheridge, a Democrat, held that seat for a while, but it's been, you know, a Republican district, and it's been a very strong Republican district. And I think the general feeling is if Holding loses, it'll be a nightmare night for the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. You could be talking about massive losses of seats. If they lose that seat, then I think it just shows a nightmare scenario for the Republican parties in general across the country. You know, he'll be swept up in that wave.
So it's a bellwether, is what you're saying. And we had been discussing this earlier, because we're also seeing this sort of...
But it shouldn't be a bellwether. I mean, it's a bellwether for this election, but traditionally it's not a bellwether seat.
Right, that's correct. But let's actually give you the poll results. So this is specific to North Carolina's second congressional district, and there were 538 registered voters that were likely to vote in this election, and they 43% went to George Holding, 44% to Linda Coleman, the Democratic candidate. She was also a two-time lieutenant gubernatorial candidate as well, wasn't she?
That's correct. She lost to Forrest twice.
Okay, all right. And then the Libertarian candidate is at 2%. But this is the reason that this is significant. So Holding is down by a point. This is actually reflected in his campaign polling as well as Coleman's. I believe he was down by 2 points in both of their polls. Ours indicates he's down by 1 point. But this is significant, again, for the reasons that Ray was stating. This is a historically Republican district. The Cook Political Report referred to this as a likely Republican and now has shifted it to lean Republican. Do you think they're actually going to downgrade it again to a toss-up?
I don't think so, but it's just too hard to say. It's possible with some of the latest polling comes out. It looks like it's a toss-up, but all that can change even in just a few weeks in the, you know, in terms of elections. And some of it could possibly be related to I think him just connecting with voters, does he do a better job of going out and getting his message out? Because to me, it seems like he has a little problem getting his message out and really honing that. You know, George Holding doesn't seem like, to me, a dynamic stump speaker, someone can go out and rouse a crowd. So maybe that's a little bit of the problem that he's having in terms of connecting with voters right now.
Do you think this district is, do you think he has maybe taken for granted that this district leaned so strongly in his direction that he wasn't stumping as much as he should have or speaking? Because think about this. So one of the, and these poll results will be made available shortly at our website, but a lot of people in his district support the federal tax reform plan. That's above water. Holding had come out in support of that. So that's a plus for him. As well as one of the chief or the primary reason, top federal issue that many of the people in this poll indicated as being important to them was jobs in the economy. And jobs in the economy are doing well in our state and our nation. So I'm trying to understand the disconnect, and I'm wondering though if it is because he hasn't maybe been campaigning as much as he should have been. Perhaps he was taking it for granted that it would just fall his direction. I don't know.
I don't think that's an unreasonable idea to put forward, because I'm sure there's a lot of Republican candidates out there who have coasted to comfortable elections, and now the polls are tightening. A lot of this, I think, just has to do with the disaffected nature voters have with Congress right now, and especially the House of Representatives. I mean, we're, like we've mentioned ad nauseum on this podcast, $23 trillion in debt. There's been no real efforts by the Republican Party in Congress to control spending or curtail spending. So I think there's just a disenchantment with a lot of Republican parties on Capitol Hill. People see Trump up in D.C., and they may be a Trump supporter, but they may have no loyalty to the Republicans in Congress. They see them as part of the swamp or just sort of the status quo. So there's a lot of dynamics going on. I think Holding will still win this race, but it's going to be close, and he can't take it for granted anymore. I think the polling shows that.
Maybe too close for comfort, and yeah. Well, let's just go back to these crosstabs. I love digging into these crosstabs.
Yeah, you mentioned a good one to me about age.
Okay, today. Yeah, so let me go back to that. So the age differential for those supporting Holding. Yeah, this is fascinating. So again, 43% of likely voters in George Holding's North Carolina 2 district said they would vote for him. However, between the 18 and 34 demographic, only 28% said they would vote for him. And then you see a big jump between the 35 and 49 year old age group, where they say 47% of those would vote for him. That's 19, almost 20 points. So why is that jump? What do you think, Ray?
Well, I think older voters are probably more familiar with George Holding. That's one reason. They know who their congressman is.
He served 3 terms,
yeah,
right?
So I think that. And, you know, older voters tend to vote more. They tend to be a little bit more active in the political process. So they're familiar with George Holding. They don't have any complaints with George Holding. He doesn't seem like a guy, you know, from what I know of him, that rocks the boat too much. He's a safe pick. So I think there's that aspect. I think older voters are more inclined to probably support the tax cuts because they pay more taxes. So I think there's that aspect of it. And I think there's just a general sort of feeling that older voters in general are just a little bit more conservative. And so George Holding's benefiting from that too.
I think that those are some important takeaways that really apply not only to George Holding's district, but wherever you're at, if you're watching or listening to us on the radio or watching on Facebook Live, people that are older tend to vote more, and that's going to impact the results
him.
Of the election. And that generally helps Republicans if unless you see a huge push by the Democrats.
Unless the seniors have to eat dog food, then yes, it does help. It does help Republicans. Are you old enough to remember the scare in the 1990s about senior citizens having to eat dog food?
Oh, I was like 3 in the 90s, Ray. Just kidding. But no, I don't remember that. However, I think one more thing on the Holding poll, and I actually then want to pivot a little bit over to voter ID and those results on that poll. But unaffiliated voters are 33% swung toward Holding, 45% to Linda Coleman. And the unaffiliated voting block is the fastest growing one in the state of North Carolina, and it's the second largest. So honestly, if you're going to put some stock in something, I would really be watching those unaffiliated right now, because they have the ability, and because of their massive size, have the ability to swing this either way. Really quickly, let's also discuss, in this poll, we asked these NC2 voters whether or not they supported voter ID on the constitutional as a constitutional amendment. It is making its way onto our ballot in November. You will have a chance, if you live in North Carolina, to vote for voter ID. And that one overwhelmingly, regardless of whether that individual that was polled lived in an urban area, suburban or rural, they were overwhelmingly in support of voter ID, 60% plus, 58% in the suburban area, but 68% in rural North Carolina, 61% in urban. So this is, that's a, you know, just a strong indicator that voter ID is doing well. We already noticed that in several other districts that we polled, and this is just another one. But you'll still be prepared as we get closer to November. The voter ID debate is going to become even more vitriolic because it is largely being peddled as a racist constitutional amendment by those on the left. And so if you're not familiar enough with why this isn't racist and you don't have enough enough information to be able to defend why voter ID is vital, then let me refer you to our website again, because we've written extensively on this. So head over to nccivitas.org. We're going to be talking about it. We'll actually be doing a video series on it as well, just policy explainers talking about why voter ID matters and rebutting some of the chief arguments against it.
Good points, Brooke. Tell us about another poll that I think voters will really be interested in.
Yeah, this one broke last night. We released it on our website this morning, but it broke in the other news media last night. And this is the Silent Sam support approval disapproval poll. And this was a statewide one. So the one we just talked about was NC2 specific, but this one is statewide. And it's so the exact text of the question was, as you may know, protesters recently toppled a bronze statue of a Confederate soldier known as Silent Sam on the campus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Do you approve or disapprove of the crowd toppling the Silent Sam statue? And Ray, go ahead and give them our results. Do you?
Yeah, there was 70% on the first question. 70% were against the toppling of Silent Sam. I actually thought that wasn't quite as high as I would think. When we're dealing in a situation in this country with mob rule, whether it's Kavanaugh hearings or just general sort of disenfranchisement with government, maybe you're just angry that Trump won, or maybe you're angry with Congress. I think there's a general enchantment with what's going on in Washington, the nation. I see you're seeing that mob rule with the Confederate statues too. Whatever position you take, it seems like taking down private property is not going to be popular, or public property without permission is not going to be popular. So, you know, 70 against it, 22% for it. Donald made an interesting comment yesterday that there wasn't much difference between the rural and urban breakdown on this issue, that it was pretty standard across the state. What I thought was interesting was that the African-American support for toppling the statue was not even at 50%. It was 44-something, Brooke, I think I saw. And I think that sort of dovetails on some comments that Andrew Young, who was a former lieutenant of Martin Luther King, made, that you know, this is not a huge issue in the black community. It's probably a bigger issue with white liberals and white radicals.
I think you might be right. Yeah, so the African-American population that approved of the toppling of Silent Sam. Now, again, let's untangle this. There are two different conversations that need to be had. So there is the mob-like behavior that was exhibited on August 20th at Chapel Hill, where they actually tore down Silent Sam unlawfully. And then there's the other aspect where we can actually have a conversation about whether or not Confederate monuments and memorials belong on public properties. So these are two different conversations. But when it comes to toppling Silent Sam illegally, 44% of those surveyed that were African-American approved of it. And any other race or ethnicity that's non-white, 32% approved. But the African-American disapproval rate was at 37%, and other minority disapproval rate was at 56%. So this is by no means, again, don't treat the African-American group as monolithic when it comes to this particular issue, or at least the handling of Silent Sam. One thing that I thought was interesting were the gender differences on this. Mm. So 27% of females approved the toppling of Silent Sam, whereas only 14% of males. And so that's a 13-point difference just between females and males, regardless of race, age, et cetera. So I thought that was kind of interesting, because females, by and large, are considered maybe the more docile gender of the two, but more females supported, you know, illegally removing the monument. So yeah. I think that might just be because of the appeal. Some females, and I know I am making a generalization here, but some females are more, I would say, mercy motivated, and they feel like if there is a group that is being disenfranchised or mistreated, then, you know, mama bear rises up. Yeah. I can say that in my own experience with my own children or other people. If I've seen someone treated unjustly, I'll get in their face. I'll get in the people who are doing that injustice in their face. And so I think that's kind of where we're seeing that. But Ray, there's another question that we asked in the survey, and you want to unpack that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I think the question was about, you know, whether, remind me of the question, bro.
Okay, it's regardless of your feelings regarding Silent Sam being toppled, do you favor or oppose legally removing Confederate monuments?
So that was split even, right? Pretty even?
Yeah, so the total in favor of legally removing the monuments, 39%. Total opposed is still 50%, okay. Though. So, and that's with a, I believe it was a 4% 4% margin of error. So even still, people are still in more opposition to removing them than they are in favor of it. So definitely there is an ongoing conversation that we continue to have in this nation and in our state regarding the way in which we handle these memorials and monuments.
Yeah, I think the only troubling thing for me is this attitude that the ends justify the means, so to speak. And to me, anytime you have mob rule, anytime you have a sort of cadre of people that take the law into their own hand and say that this is okay because we feel aggrieved or because we think that this is just right, creates a system of vigilantism. And I watched a movie over the last few weeks called The Oxbow Incident with Henry Fonda. I think it was 1943 is when the film came out. And it's just an indictment against vigilantism. And it was just a reminder to me about how dangerous it can be when you take the law into your hands. We're a nation of laws. We have a rule of law. When we talk about liberty, we should talk about ordered liberty in terms of just defining what liberty means, that there's a process to ordering it. There's a process to reforming our culture and our government, and we have to be mindful of that. So to me, it's just disappointing to see people thinking that it's okay to do illegal acts like this. And you know, there's always a context for standing up to the government and pushing back. But in terms of just mob rule, that always has a dangerous outcome.
Well, I think this is the difference between, this is the epitome of the difference between the French and American revolutions. There was, and the difference between direct democracy and a republic.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so right now, you know, we hear rah, rah, democracy, yay, without understanding the way in which a republic serves as a restraint upon the mob rule. And that's how our founders designed our government. It was a republic if you can keep it, is what Benjamin Franklin said. And if anything, this decision to illegally remove Silent Sam opens up this conversation yet again. And we constantly have times in history where we get to discuss this. And that's, are we going to be a nation that is ruled by laws? And if they are unjust laws, we're doing what we need to do to overturn them. Or are we going to be a nation that says, okay, popular opinion rules, or the people with the biggest stick are the ones that are able to assert their, you know, their preferences. And there's a fundamental difference, and it will impact every system and institution depending on how we just look at the difference between democracy versus republic, that is a republic that functions under a constitution that is attuned to the rights of individual liberties and religious liberties and private property and things like that. So you know, let's get back to the basics. Yep. And when we're talking about these things,
I think the big issue is with mob rule is, where does it end too? I mean, do you because you don't like Jesse Helms and some of
it
his
ends in the reign
stuff,
of terror. That's how it ended.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, lopping off people's heads in the guillotine in the French Revolution, as Brooke mentioned. But I mean, do you vandalize graves of former Confederate officers? Do you attack and topple Jesse Helms' grave because you disagree with something he did? I know there's been some vandalism of his grave in Raleigh before, and so it just becomes this sort of these heinous acts that are ugly and filthy, and I don't think should reflect anywhere in our should reflect anything in our politics today. And so I think just this fundamental breakdown of law is very distressing. You saw it a lot in the Kavanaugh hearings, the sort of disruptions, and we're not going to accept this nomination. And, you know, we talked about this last week, but, you know, the speech by Ben Sasse, we talked about filtering your politics in the appropriate medium and not taking it into every sphere. And, you know, we have an over-politicized society today.
It has become the religion.
Yeah, it really has.
Of many Americans.
Yeah, and the rise of secularism, unfortunately, creates a politicized nation where it's all about the here and now. And everything is just so, so hinges on whatever happens in this sort of political environment now. And so the hysteria goes overboard. And it's distressing to see, and it's not a good sign for our nation going forward.
Yeah. So let's do our part, right? Let's do our part to be civic educators. That's what we do at Civitas. That's our heart and our desire is to remove the barriers to freedom, but also to educate the public. And that's why we're even doing this on the radio, on Facebook Live. We want to connect with you all. We're out of time for today, Ray. It's been a great discussion. And we're praying for everybody in the path of Hurricane Florence and hoping that I don't eat all of my hurricane snack food.
I think that's a big issue for everybody. Yeah. We appreciate your support and time, and thank you for all you do out there and help us to amplify the voice at Civitas. So we appreciate everything you do.